The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Smith, Judge Rodenberg, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals for our first case on for oral argument this morning, which is State of Minnesota v. Jackson. I would say welcome to the Court of Appeals, but welcome to your basements or closets or wherever you are. For the record, I will say what the parties are all aware of, which is that we are hosting these oral arguments today, not at the Minnesota Judicial Center, but in light of the ongoing pandemic emergency declared by the state of Minnesota. We are hosting these oral arguments via Zoom, an online platform. But just so council is aware, although we can see each other now and we can see each other's names, we are going to be maintaining only an audio recording of the proceedings, as we always do. So please state your name as you commence each leg of the argument so that for the audio recording, your argument is attached to the proper attorney. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that for rebuttal. And if at any time during the proceedings you're having a hard time hearing or seeing any one of the participants or the judges, just flag us and we'll pause the proceedings and figure out the technology as we go. And with that, counsel for appellant, you have the floor.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Anders Erickson and I represent the appellant this morning, Jamal Jackson. Mr. Jackson is requesting that this court reverse his second degree intentional murder conviction and remand for a new trial. Mr. Jackson's request is based on two arguments. First, that the trial court violated his right to present a meaningful defense. And second, that the court committed reversible error by allowing the state to present inadmissible Spriegel evidence. I would like to start this morning with the Spriegel issue to make sure that there is no confusion regarding the record related to the state's request to introduce the prior bad act evidence only as Spriegel evidence.
Well, before you get there, I hate to derail your plan, but I do have a couple of questions about your evidence argument, and I'm a little confused by it. So help me to understand the relationship between the gun, given that Mr. Jackson was not aware of it, and any of the elements necessary for him to sustain a self-defense defense.
Yeah, so first off, Mr. Jackson's defense was that Mr. Oliphant was out to get him and that he had threatened him that he was either going to take action against Mr. Jackson or he was going to hire somebody to do so. The self-defense elements, one of them is an objective element, whether there's objective grounds that support his belief in the record. So evidence that Mr. Oliphant, who Mr. Jackson feared, actually had a gun in his vehicle right next to where the shooting took place is objective evidence that supports the reasonable belief that he would fear Mr. Oliphant and his associates.
Right. I saw that in your brief, but I'm confused by it because it seems to me that there's a direct relationship between the second element and the third element of the self-defense defense. And without evidence of the second, the third is not relevant at all. I mean, the third element is the existence of a reasonable ground. That's the one you're talking about, right?
That's correct.
A reasonable ground for the belief.
Yep.
But isn't the belief that we're talking about the defendant's actual and honest belief? So if that's so, for the existence of the gun in Mr. Oliphant's car to be relevant at all to Mr. Jackson's self-defense defense theory, doesn't there have to be some plausible effect on his mental process from knowledge about the, or from the evidence about the gun?
Well, Your Honor, I think they do go hand in hand in that he still needs to have a subjective, reasonable belief that there was going to be harm done to himself. And this absolutely goes to that as well, as far as him having this prior belief that these guys were out to get him. It's not random person on the street.
But the third element has to bear upon the second element. How can the gun have any bearing on his belief if he is not aware of the gun? Walk us through the mental processes that are affected by the existence of a gun about which Mr. Jackson is completely unaware in the car of someone who didn't do the shooting.
Right. So I think we need to start at the beginning, which is his subjective fear prior to even walking across the street. And his subjective fear was that Mr. Oliphant was going to harm him and that he was going to hire somebody else to hire him, to harm him, excuse me. When he was interacting with Mr. Pennington, at that point, he believed that Mr. Pennington was an associate of Mr. Oliphant and that was going to harm him. With this evidence, this objective evidence that the person that Mr. Jackson feared was out to get him had a firearm in his car, that supports his subjective belief that these guys were out to get him.
Well, doesn't have to have a connection to his subjective belief. How does it affect his subjective belief if he's not aware of it? How can anything affect his belief if the thing is something unknown to him?
Well, let's go back to the relevant standard, right? So if the evidence has any likelihood of making it more probable than not that Mr. Jackson has a subjective belief that these guys are going to harm him, then it's relevant.
Right.
And but how absolutely does it absolutely does.
But if he doesn't know about it, how does it affect his, but let me ask it a different way. How would adopting this theory be faithful to the Supreme Court's reasoning in Zumberg?
Zumberg, as far as that's the case, the state sided with the guy with that was feeding the deer. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So in that case, all of the evidence they were trying to bring in was prior acts. It had nothing to do with what was going on at the time.
I'm talking about the reasoning of the court and the lack of knowledge.
Right. But I think it also goes to what was his fear at that time, and it had nothing to do with prior domestic assaults between the two individuals across the street. It had nothing to do with one of the people across the street urinating on his property. That had nothing to do with self-defense. In this case, Mr. Jackson's fear, his subjective fear, was premised on the idea that Mr. Oliphant was going to harm him or hire someone to harm him. And I think another way to look at this is let's say the police officers searched Mr. Oliphant's car and there was not a firearm. That would have absolutely been relevant. Absolutely the prosecutor would ask the police officer.
I've often understood this third element this way, that a reasonable person in the defendant's shoes, objectively, given this evidence, would have a basis for the belief that he was in imminent fear. Not just that he was actually in imminent fear, that he believed he was in imminent fear, but this third element bears on his belief so that a reasonable person would be affected by the evidence. But a reasonable person couldn't be any more affected by the evidence than your client was, because a reasonable person in your client's shoes wouldn't have known about the evidence.
But I also see it the other way too, that it's objective evidence that the jury needs to consider as a basis for why he had this fear to start from, right? Why would Mr. Jackson pull a gun quickly on somebody if there was no basis for him to believe that these guys were out to get him, right? Is he just have some crazy idea that these guys were out to get him for no reason? It supports his theory objectively that these guys weren't just hanging out, having a good time. One of them had a firearm within feet of where Mr. Jackson was. Absolutely, Mr. Jackson didn't know about it at the time, and that's not the sole reason he fired the gun. But it goes to his belief that when Mr. Jackson's theory that Mr. Pennington was reaching for something, that in his mind, he knew that these guys were up to something and that Mr. Oliphant was out to get him. So absolutely, he didn't know about it, but it supports the objective evidence that supports his belief that these guys were going to potentially harm him.
Counsel, and just to maybe wrap this up, so it seems like the difference is, you know, whether it's reasonable based on what he knew, which you reject as the test, based on what he knew, was it reasonable to fear? you think was it reasonable to fear based on things that he didn't know. Is there any case that you would point, what case would you point to that makes it relevant to determine whether it is reasonable to fear based on something the person didn't know? I mean, what's your best case for this proposition?
Well, I think State v. Johnson, which is a 2006 Supreme Court case, discusses that it's an objective element that goes, that the third element, or excuse me, the fourth element is an objective element. So it has nothing to do with what he believes at that time or what information he might have. It's objectively, what are the relevant, what's the relevant evidence at the time of the incident? That, and that's contrasted to the third element, which is of course subjective. So why wouldn't it be relevant when this is an objective piece of evidence that existed at the time? And it's certainly not prejudicial either, right? The state could easily have presented it in a way that the jury would know that Mr. Jackson didn't know that there was a gun there. And that's the test. It's,
you know, I think Minnesota's self-defense elements are pretty consistent with courts across the country dealing with self-defense. It's sort of rooted in common law principles. Now Johnson, of course, does not involve the facts like our case, where you're talking about something about which the defendant is completely unaware. So have you found any case in Minnesota or anywhere in the country where your theory is supported by the facts of the case, where a court found relevant evidence about which the defendant had no knowledge?
I don't have any cases from Minnesota or from across the country that specifically state that.
I'm not saying specifically state it, but that involve facts like this one where it's been applied in the way that you're asking us to apply it.
No, I have not, Your Honor. Specifically in Minnesota either, I've not found any cases. I think that the analysis in Bjork and Nystrom supports what I'm talking about, and that in both those cases, it's just this general idea of fearing where they are, whether it's in a prison or in a dangerous neighborhood, that wouldn't necessarily come in. But these are objective facts related to the incident, right? That Mr. Jackson made it clear all along. He made notice of his self-defense claim. He presented evidence. He testified about it, that he feared Mr. Oliphant. The jury, without this evidence, just thinks that Mr. Oliphant was sitting in his car picking up his girlfriend at the bar, which is clearly not the case. He had a gun. He had a large amount of cash. He had narcotics. You know, we're not arguing that the narcotics should have come in, but I think it's extremely relevant to have a paint the whole picture for Mr. Jackson's defense that these guys may have been up to something.
Counsel, can we turn to what you were going to open with, which is a Spriegel? I think we all understand the facts. I think there was a ruling before trial on that as a Spriegel incident. I think the state didn't introduce it. On direct, the appellant was asked where he got the gun. And then on cross, he was asked why he bought it. And then he explained why. And then the evidence came in rebuttal, right?
That's correct.
That's how it worked. What, why, I guess, how is there, I guess one question I have is how could there be prejudice, even if the Spriegel determination is wrong, if the evidence could have come in anyway on rebuttal to rebut what he had said while he testified?
Well, I don't think it could have come in to rebut during rebuttal. There's absolutely no support for that. The state asked,
why is that? If he was asked, he said that he was, you know, assaulted by a UFC fighter or something, you know, on the street. Wasn't his description of why he bought the gun related to the same incident that the state put rebuttal testimony on?
Yeah, to clarify the record, on direct, when Mr. Jackson was testifying, he never talked about the incident.
Right, I understand that.
Cross-examination, the state asked him, why did you buy this gun? What happened the day before? So the state is the one who's introducing this, and they're introducing it because the court allowed him to do so under Spriegel, because they provided notice, and it was litigated, and the court said it can come in under Spriegel. There's nothing about that this could come in as rebuttal because somehow he brought it in during his testimony, and therefore the state needed to clarify things, and therefore it's not a bad act that was introduced under Spriegel. There's just no connection or support for that.
So it's not impeachment evidence if they ask him, why did you get it? And he gives a reason that they have evidence is untrue for them to put in the evidence of the real reason why?
Absolutely not. One, he testified that he was punched in the face by a UFC fighter, which is exactly what happened. Two, if the state wants to introduce Spiegel evidence and go and they litigate it and there's an order on it, they shouldn't have the right then to ask the defendant during cross-examination, then have it somehow change to Spiegel or to impeachment or rebuttal evidence.
Why? If there's another basis for the evidence to come in, I mean, often pieces of evidence have various purposes. And if one is invalid as a rationale, it's still admissible. It's not inadmissible for the other basis. So why, I don't understand your argument as to why it is the state would not be allowed to introduce evidence of as rebuttal evidence, regardless of a Spiegel determination.
Because it would absolutely destroy 404B and Spiegel. Because
how?
The state never said this can come in now as rebuttal evidence. The court never ruled on it. The state introduced it, provided the notice. There was a cautionary instruction that came in right before it. Everybody believed it was coming in as Spiegel evidence. The state never said, judge, you know, now that he's testified about this because we asked him questions, it's now rebuttal evidence. So now it's not Spiegel. Now your earlier ruling can't be reviewed on appeal. The state never asked the court to make any determination because everybody in the courtroom believed it was coming in as Spiegel evidence. 404B does not allow the state to ask a question of a defendant after a Spiegel ruling and then be able to bring it in on rebuttal just because they asked the question on cross-examination. That would completely destroy the rule and the prohibition of bad act evidence coming in.
Well, he could have just, on that point, he could have given an answer that wouldn't have implicated the prior incident. In other words, if he had said, I bought the firearm for self-protection, if he had just left it at that, then that wouldn't be the same sort of situation that we've got on the record, right?
Well, the state specifically asked him, and if I can quote, did you remember, you said, you bought it on April 10th, 2018. Do you remember the morning before you bought the gun? Yes. What caused you to buy the gun? And it was specifically asking about the morning before. The state, if we're talking about opening the door, which the defense didn't do, the state is the one who opened the door by asking these questions. I think it would just completely, in every self-defense case where there's contested Spiegel evidence, the state could do this. They could ask one question and then claim, oh, because we didn't like the answer, we're going to bring it in during rebuttal and you can't appeal it. That doesn't make any sense and would just destroy the rule. If the court doesn't have any questions, I see my time's out. I can respond in rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson. We will see you in your rebuttal period. Counsel for the state.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Peter Magnuson. I'm Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the respondent state of Minnesota. With respect to the first issue, it's an abuse of discretion standard of review here, and I don't believe, as the questions have posed by the panel have indicated, I don't believe that there was any abuse of discretion. But apart from that, I'll just touch base on the prejudice part of it, even assuming, which I don't concede, of course, but even assuming that there was an abuse of discretion, there still has to be sufficient prejudice to warrant a new trial. And I don't believe that hurdle has been met here either. There's an inconsistency in appellant's argument that I don't think can be overcome on the prejudice part. The self-defense claim is premised on this belief that he was afraid that Melvin Oliphant wanted to kill him. Yet, appellant gets across the street because he willingly walked across the street to talk to Melvin Oliphant. So it's appellant's own testimony that more severely undercuts the self-defense claim. I just don't see it gets past the prejudice prong. The same thing on the second issue.
I'll just pause you there. I mean, Mr. Jackson did testify didn't he, that he thought there was a bulge in Mr. Pennington's waistband, or said some belief that maybe Mr. Pennington had a gun. If that's true, then, I mean, at least there would have been enough for the jury to reach the conclusion that he had an actual and honest belief that he was in imminent danger from Mr. Pennington.
Yes, but I'm just referring to the prejudice from the district court keeping out the gun in Oliphant's car.
Right, but if Mr. Jackson's appellate theory is plausible, and the third element can be established based upon evidence of a danger unknown to the defendant, then it seems to me to be that evidence would be relevant if the second prong might be met on a different theory of danger, which is danger from Mr. Pennington rather than from Mr. Oliphant's car. I'm not suggesting that I agree with the theory. I'm just saying if the theory is valid, it seems to me that that it is prejudicial, because that's the only missing prong in the self-defense theory, right?
But there is absolutely no connection established between any gun in Oliphant's car and a gun with Pennington. If there was some indication that there had passing of a gun,
I was suggesting, if we adopted Mr. Erickson's argument on behalf of Mr. Jackson, that there really doesn't have to be a relationship between the second and third element at all.
I'm not seeing that the same way. Under appellant's version of events, there would be two guns. The bulge, the suspected gun in Pennington's waistband, and the gun in the car.
Yes, that would be his theory, that he feared that there was a gun in Mr. Pennington's car, and that there was a gun, creating a reasonable grounds Mr. Jackson's presentation of what it means to be objective evidence. It seems to me that you'd have all the elements met.
Well, he's still being allowed to testify that he saw the bulge in Mr. Pennington's waistband and that he believed that might be a gun. But the issue is whether the district court's exclusion of knowledge of the gun in the car, is that prejudicial? And I don't see that there's a connection. He would still be able to advance his theory that he feared the gun in Pennington's waistband. But the whole thing is just undercut by his, on the one hand, testifying he was afraid that Oliphant wanted to kill him, but then he willingly goes across the street to interact with them. With respect to the second issue, it's a similar prejudice. I don't see that there's any prejudice, even assuming, again, this is abuse of discretion standard. I don't see that there was an abuse of discretion by the district court in allowing this. But even if there was, this is a very tangential issue. As I note in my brief, this is only 6 pages of testimony from a trial that spanned the better part of 5 days. I don't think there's any prejudice here that would warrant a reversal and a new trial. That's so all I wanted.
You're talking about the Spriegel incident, is that right?
The rebuttal evidence, yes.
Okay, and you didn't, I don't think, defend the Spriegel decision in your brief. You presented it as a plain error issue, I think. But the district court had said that it could come in. So the state could have brought it in directly as a Spriegel incident. Instead, the state chose to first ask the defendant a question about it. What's wrong with the appellant's argument that, you know, it just sort of swallows up the Spriegel issue in a way that's unfair when it had already been ruled that it was going to come in, that asking a question shouldn't, you know, completely obviate the need to actually evaluate that and whether it should come in at all?
Well, I apologize. I don't have the transcript here in front of me. I don't believe that there was an objection posed at the time. I could be wrong on that. But if there wasn't an objection posed, then that issue wasn't placed front and center with the district.
An objection court. To what? An objection to the state's question of the appellant?
Yes.
Or an objection to putting a witness on, a Spriegel witness?
No, an objection to the question of the appellant.
And well, why would there be an objection if the Spriegel decision had already been made in favor of the state?
Well, as I see it, the argument is that he shouldn't have been allowed, the state shouldn't have been allowed to, as characterized by appellant's counsel, open the door by asking this question that prompted the response that then prompted the state to introduce this rebuttal evidence. So it seems to me if that was the argument, then there should have been an objection posed to that question.
What would the objection be if the evidence, if the issue had already been resolved by the district court before trial?
Well, I could have objected. Could have objected based on relevance. What was the relevance of that question to the appellant?
Didn't the Spriegel decision already resolve the question of relevance?
Yes, I believe it did. I believe it did.
So on what basis would the defendant be making another objection to an issue that's already been decided against the defendant?
I guess I'm making too technical an argument here that is digging me a hole that I don't want to continue digging in. So I will leave well enough alone on that and stop digging my hole, and I'll put my shovel down. If the court has any other questions, I'd be happy to address them. Otherwise, I don't think.
In light of your, I don't want to call it a concession. I don't want to give too much, but in light of your decision to quit digging in that hole, I'd like you to go back to the question that Judge Smith asked you then. So now, assuming that there is no plausible reason for the defendant to object on a matter that's already been decided by the court, what's the basis for us to review this any other way than Spriegel?
Well, it came in a rebuttal, and I'm not aware of case law that talks about Spriegel applying to rebuttal evidence. I may be wrong about that, but I...
Right, but if the Spriegel ruling was inappropriate, let's assume that the Spriegel ruling was inappropriate. Let's say we went down that path. In your alternative theory that this is impeachment, it's rebuttal evidence... why would we evaluate it that way if the district court didn't decide it that way? How do we know how the district court would have decided, and what's the procedural mechanism by which we would affirm based upon this alternative theory? I guess is the question that I'm asking.
I'm not sure I understood the question completely, but I think an objection should have been posed then at the time when the rebuttal witness was called and this testimony was brought out.
Well, I'm probably asking the same question as Judge Ross, but I'm asking it in the context of my experience as a district court judge. If the district court judge has already made that Spriegel determination and that's been fully briefed and argued and decided, making another objection to a thing that wasn't even identified at trial as the reason it was being brought in would just be a waste of time. Defense counsel would have no reason to make that objection because the lay of the land was that evidence was coming in.
Yes, I see the point. I don't think it changes my prejudice argument that there was insufficient prejudice to warrant reversal here and warrant a new trial.
And the prejudice would be that even if the district court hadn't ruled as it did, the state would have pursued the same line of questioning, but for a different reason.
Yes, and it just assuming there but was prejudice.
But if that's the course, then I want to go back to the colloquy that Judge Smith and Mr. Erickson had, which is, okay, so assuming that the Spriegel approach was inappropriate, the state would then be baiting the defendant to go into a circumstance that was impermissible by beginning the question with, hey, remember the day before? Let's talk. I want to take you back to that time. And why did you buy the gun? They're sort of tempting the defendant to answer the question in a way that the state would want the answer in order to open the door. It seems like a shaky basis on which to affirm if I'm right about the sort of baiting of the witness.
As you pointed out in a question, merely because a piece of evidence has been excluded on one grounds doesn't mean that it wouldn't also be admissible on another ground here.
Right, but let's assume the district court then improperly decided Spriegel. Would the prosecutor's question, the framing of the prosecutor's question about the day before the gun was purchased, would that have been proper?
Yes. I think so. I think that would have been a permissible question.
Even if the court had ruled the other way with regard to the state's Spriegel request?
I'd have to go back and look at the transcript and what led up to the state's question. It's a pretty small issue, but as I recall, appellant was trying to paint himself as being the non-aggressor and that he needed this gun for protection, which I think he was trying to paint himself that he was a victim in that case and that he was a victim in this case. I think that was the reasoning behind the state's question. And if that's correct, then I believe then the question would have been proper. I see my time is almost up. I would just ask the court to affirm the convictions and reject appellant's claims. Thank you.
I don't see any other questions from the panel, so thank you. Counsel for appellant, rebuttal.
Thank you. I just want to clarify that the Spriegel evidence coming in during rebuttal was not conditioned on Mr. Jackson testifying about why he got the gun. That evidence was conditioned on him testifying that he acted in self-defense. That's why the trial court allowed it in, was because the state argued that he claimed self-defense in both cases, which is just not true, but that's why it was coming in. It's not like he testified about this incident regarding why he got the gun, and then that was the reason why they brought the evidence in rebuttal. That was never discussed. That was not the state's position. This is the first time anyone's ever brought this up as to why that evidence came in. I also, even
the
if
the state counsel, the state was, I mean, this, his subjective fear was certainly a relevant issue. And his subjective fear, if the state chose to ask him about that, why were you in a state of fear such that you bought a gun that you had? I mean, why is his mental state, even about buying the gun that he used, not, I mean, it's relevant, is it not? I mean, it may have opened the door to a rebuttal to why he claimed to be in a state of fear, but, you know.
Are you saying that the reason he bought the gun was why he shot Mr. Pennington?
No, it's why he was carrying the gun, right? I mean, wasn't he showing himself, he bought the gun because he feared he needed protection, right?
Well, that is unrelated to his fear of Mr. Oliphant And
yeah, that's true.
This is completely separate incident, has nothing to do with it. And even if it was could come in as rebuttal evidence, I don't know what is being rebutted. There isn't anything relevant to the case that he testified, that after this car accident, he confronted this guy and the guy punched him in the face. It really has nothing to do with anything. This idea that then that witness can come in and testify that he thought Mr. Jackson was driving drunk, stole a car, crashed the car a bunch of times. I don't know how that comes in as rebuttal. I don't know what that's rebutting.
So he's carrying the, so why he bought the gun, which was related to the DWI incident, was not relevant to why he was then, I guess you're saying to the incident where he's carrying a gun later and then uses it to shoot Mr. Pennington.
If anything, that would support Mr. Jackson's theory, but that wasn't his theory. He was never asked about that during his direct examination when he testified. He never brought that to the table as, I'm scared because of that last incident, so I'm carrying a gun, and then Mr. Pennington was reaching for a gun, and that's why I shot him. Came in because the prosecutor asked him why he bought it, because the evidence came in that he had legally purchased the gun from a gun dealer.
Let's take a bigger picture view of this issue. Let's assume, for the sake of my question, that we decide that you're wrong about the gun in the car, the evidence being admissible, and that therefore there is no basis on which a self-defense theory is plausible. If that is so, how would this evidence, the Spriegel evidence, be anything more than a harmless error at most?
Well, I think the Spriegel goes more to his subjective belief and whether he had the, you know, because of his prior bad act, because he's does crazy things, that therefore he would make this up about Mr. Pennington reaching for the gun.
Right.
Propensity evidence, basically.
Right.
So that would go to the subjective element.
Right. But that only goes to self-defense. And without your theory of self-defense, there's not enough evidence to support self-defense, because there's a third element that's missing. And if that's so, there's no objective basis for a belief in your client, a reasonable basis to believe that Mr. Pennington posed a threat to him, then help me to understand why the Spriegel evidence is nothing more than harmless. No, because the jury knows that your client brought a gun to the scene, and that your client fired the gun at Mr. Pennington. So what more to help me to understand why the Spriegel evidence is anything more than a minor concern, given the overwhelming evidence of your client's guilt.
A few things. And if I could just clarify, I know my time's running out here. Is your question that if you affirm on issue one and say that the gun didn't need to be introduced, that therefore there's no way of establishing harm on issue two for the subjective element?
Yes. And
saying that they're kind of piggyback on each other. You need both or nothing.
Well, to complete the circle of the way you framed it. And therefore there is no basis in this record, because there's an element missing for self-defense, that there's no basis in this record to support self-defense. And therefore the Spriegel evidence goes to what, how does it affect the jury's rationale, and how is it anything more than harmless for the evidence?
Right. So if the Spriegel evidence doesn't come in, the jury doesn't hear any of the propensity evidence that's highly inflammatory and prejudicial. Our theory is that if the jury doesn't hear that and believes Mr. Jackson's testimony that Mr. Pennington was reaching for a gun, that's self-defense. And that it wasn't this over-the-top conduct of shooting somebody without any basis, that the jury could then believe him because they didn't have this propensity evidence to lean on, that he saw Mr. Pennington reach for a gun and had threatened him before reaching for the gun. So I don't think they go hand in hand. I do think if you agree with me on issue one and on both issues, that the prejudice go together, and that I don't think you can affirm if you reverse on or agree with me on both issues, because one goes to the objective, one goes to the subjective. But independently, I still think you can reverse because theirs were not harmless. Judge Rumberg, did you have a question? I'm sorry.
I think you pretty much answered what my question is going to be, and that is to say that you answered it.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, so if I could just conclude that, all this evidence is not having the gun come in and having this Spriegel evidence, while the case, I wouldn't say it was a strong case. I would say that there was a lot of uncontested evidence, and it went to the narrow issue of his mental state and whether there was objective evidence to support his belief. Because of the evidentiary errors, we're requesting that this court reverse his convictions and remand for a new trial.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson and Mr. Magnuson, for your briefing and your arguments today. We appreciate it. It's very helpful to us to have lawyers who are apprised of the law and the facts as you are, and able to joust around these difficult questions. We will take the matter under advisement now. It's submitted, and we'll issue our opinion within the statutory period.